Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. Welcome, everybody. I'm Allison Stewart. It Was All a Dream, A New Generation Confronts the Broken Promise to Black America is a new book which investigates the specific challenges facing black millennials. The title comes from Biggie Smalls' song's Juicy. The first lines go, "It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine, Salt-N-Pepa and Heavy D up in a limousine." For me, it actually brought up the Langston Hughes poem, A Dream Deferred. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat or crust and sugar over like syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode? All those questions are at the heart of Reniqua Allen's work in this book. What does the American dream mean for black Americans born between 1981 and 1996? Reniqua is a journalist, producer, and an Eisner Fellow at the Nation Institute. This is your first book, right?
It is. Oh, that's my gosh, so exciting. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so excited to have you. Congratulations, first of all. Just finishing a book, huge accomplishment. Whoa. Right there. So you spoke to more than 75 black millennials for this book. When you ask them what their definition of the American dream is, what kind of answers did you get back? Did they even connect with the idea of American dream?
Yeah, shockingly. I mean, right, so many studies show that, like, young black people actually believe in the American dream more than any other group. I was so shocked, because I think that they've really been, you know, battered by it. People gave all different definitions of the American dream. There was, like, that traditional, it's a house, picket fence, and, you know, there were a large number of folks in that camp. I want to have kids. I want a stable job. But at the core, what I really found, it was just kind of like, they wanted to be free. They wanted this freedom to be themselves, and whatever that meant. And that was something they felt like they weren't getting in this society. And I know that's all kind of like meta, but they wanted to exist in a way that just felt so constricted. They wanted to be able to pursue their dreams and opportunities. There's this one young gentleman who I'm thinking of, Simon, who was he works in tech in San Francisco. And, you know, he has made it in so many ways, but he really wanted to be a photographer. He went to MIT and everything, but he felt like he couldn't do that because his parents weren't able to afford that. And so that was like, what? You've made it. You have all the monikers of success. But, you know, he never felt like he could just dream away. And that was sad.
What were some of the obstacles they cited for being unable to exist and to just be and to be authentically themselves?
Oh, gosh, so many. I mean, racism, discrimination, you know, those sorts of things. A lot. I mean, and this is not unique to black millennials, as I'm sure you know. Financial burden, student debt was huge. And, right, like, student debt affects millennials. I think the millennial generation pretty hard. The millennial generation, I think, is not doing well overall, whether you're black, white, Latino, or Asian. We're having a really tough time. But for black millennials, we're feeling it even harder than those in the past, I think. And, oh, my gosh, the obstacles were more subtle. Like, I think that's the thing that was hard for this generation, right? Like, it wasn't like, oh, my God, someone called me the N-word, or, you know, I didn't get this job because certainly I was black. It was like the more subtle things that I just didn't feel right, or someone told me I wasn't a good fit, and I'm using the quotation marks, that they couldn't really tell. They felt unwanted. They didn't feel this connection. They felt like a burden to have to, the thing that, you know, Du Bois talked about so many years ago. They had to be two people. They had to kind of reconcile these notions. Yeah, they could like Biggie, but they also need to talk about how much they love Bon Jovi. I actually love both. But, you know, they talked about not just being able to
be. You are from Jersey.
I'm so from Jersey. You know, but they felt like they couldn't just be themselves, and they couldn't just be black, or they had to, you know, just think of so many things that I think young white millennials don't necessarily have to think about.
Yeah, part of the thesis of the book, which I think is really interesting and important for people to realize, is that when we hear all these stories about millennials, this is how they want to live, this is how they want to marry, they don't really necessarily take into account that these experiences aren't universal, and that race and ethnicity play a huge role in the decisions you make and the opportunities you get, the decisions you get to make. How did you find all of these folks to talk to, and how forthcoming were they initially?
Oh, I found them in a range of ways. I mean, some of them, I read articles about them. A couple of people said, hey, I have a great friend, you know, this might be an interesting story. Others, it was a little more organic that I did articles on them before. A young man in West Virginia was a coal miner. I'd been interested in that and went to Appalachia. So, you know, he's part of the book. Mm-hmm. A couple of people I've been tracking for years, Keisha, a housekeeper in Indianapolis. She was an activist. I'd been talking to Keisha for years to figure out what it's like to be a hotel worker. So it was a long process, I think. Mm-hmm.
How important was it to you as a journalist, and how did you accomplish this? Because sometimes this can be hard, is to make sure you're checking a whole lot of boxes. And I don't mean them just to check them, to actually really engage with people from different parts of the United States and different classes. Let's just say that word, different classes, different educational attainment. When you were putting that together, when you were actually, you know, working with your editor, tell me about some of those thoughts you had about, like, let me look at this mix.
Yeah, I had to really check my privilege, right? Like, mm-hmm. when we think about dream and opportunity, I feel like there's a certain kind of thing, right, you're checking off. But, like, I didn't want it to be in elite spaces. I didn't want to, like, success just to be defined by the MIT graduate or, you know, the person that made it to Princeton. So I talked to sex workers, you know, I talked to the Black Republican. Okay, maybe that was a box that felt a little bit that needed to be checked off. But, you know, I wanted to really think about the dream in broad ways. I wanted to look, for me, it was really important to look at Blackness in a multitude of ways. So I spoke with folks from Africa and the West Indies, which I think we overlooked that. And they actually have, I found, different views sometimes about what the dream means and opportunity, and particularly their parents as well.
So is that more of an immigrant aligned?
It was It was a more of an immigrant aligned thing, but also particularly with young people who had parents, their parents' views were different, but they also experienced what it was like to be Black in America, you know, walking through a store, no one hears their accent. And mm-hmm. I think that impacted that generation. And so there was a tension between kind of their parents and themselves. But it was interesting.
Speaking with Reniqua Allen, the name of her book is It Was All a Dream, A New Generation mm-hmm. Confronts the Broken Promise to Black America. Let's see, it's funny, we want to talk about money and debt. And I think about the 2008 recession, and I've been following the Facebook 10-year challenge like everybody else.
Right.
We'll post your picture from 10 years. But you realize, like, 10 years ago, it was scary for a lot of, for everybody, it was scary what's going to happen to the U.S. economy. Can you explain for folks listening how the 2008-2009 financial meltdown had a very distinct impact on Black millennials?
Yeah, so I'm a little bit at the older millennial. I was born in 1981. So, you know, I saw some of the challenges of the recession. I had a house and that, you know, was not great. But a lot of the people, a large bulk of the people that I interviewed, their families, their parents were impacted by it. A large number of people were homeless. Their parents had lost houses. They couldn't find a job. This generation is tremendously impacted by it. And for Black Americans, if many people don't know, they don't have the same financial cushions, particularly Black middle-class folk and Black people with degrees. I was shocked to know that they were actually hit the hardest, even harder than lower-class Black people, than the recession. So,
because they lost jobs.
Because they
had jobs and they had a certain economic certain economic place they got into.
Exactly. And that was harder for them to build back up. It's mm-hmm. easier probably to get, you know, the low-wage work job. But if you have a professional job at a company that's mm-hmm. still struggling, so it was harder for them to get it back. And so what I found was that kind of the traditional markers, while they believed in that in some way of the American dream, like seeing a parent lose a house, you're not necessarily sure that the house is the goal. So they were redefining, like, what that meant, like what home meant, which was interesting. And it necessarily sometimes wasn't the white picket fence. But for them, it was stability.
I was going to ask, what does financial security mean to a Black millennial?
Oh, I think it means different, you know, different things for different people. Like, I think for me, it's like student debt. Like, that's a big burden. But that's also a privilege, like, right? Like, not a lot of people actually finish college. Like, mm-hmm. we've been told, and I think in some ways, in part of the reporting for this book made me really question, like, that whole notion that everyone has to go to college. I think that's what we were taught, our generation particularly, when we were growing up. But this whole notion of, like, what success means and that, you know, so for me, student debt's a big part of it. But for lower wage work folks, like even just getting to school, getting a job, making $15 an hour, I think that's success for them. Though I have to say, I think one of the common themes was like healthcare. Like a lot of people just were struggling around healthcare. A lot of people were struggling around mental health. And we just didn't have it despite, you know, the reforms. People did not have money to actually take care of themselves physically and mentally. So I think that was something.
I think historically, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is true, that among Black Americans, there were two things you were supposed to get, an education and a home, education mm-hmm. and land.
Yep.
Like that was a way to make sure you were secure. The old joke was like, can't take what's in your head away from you. Can't take the education away from you. And if you can get a piece of land and something, then you can create generational wealth. That was like the big focus. And it's interesting to hear you say that the two things that historically have been the thing you aim towards, many Black millennials are questioning, wow, should I even bother to get a home? Should I even bother to put roots down somewhere because I might want to move somewhere else? Did you get any sense of, since you did interview people in the span, like you said, you're the older, and does that change as the millennials based on their age? Because you do start thinking about roots a little differently as you get older.
Absolutely. I think with the millennial generation in general, as we age, people start owning homes. I mean, even anecdotally, I think some of my friends now, I would say maybe half are thinking of homes and mortgages. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are moving away. One of the big themes in my book was that young millennials are moving to the South.
It's a chapter called We Out.
Yeah,
we're out leaving New York.
We are done with New York. Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, what that means. Yes, I do think that people are starting to look at homes, but there's a hole in housing and kind of those traditional parts of home ownership. As the dream. However, I should say that like there's a whole other contingent that just simply doesn't have the money. They don't have the means and can't do it. And it's really, really taxing on this generation and a really frustrating place, I think, for them to be in.
Tell me a little bit about that idea of Black Americans, Black millennials specifically, looking at the South and thinking, maybe that's where I will find myself, and I will be able to be myself, and I will find some opportunity. I have friends who've lived in the South for a long time who couldn't wait to leave, but because of the subtlety of the issues down there. But I'm curious about what these young folks, I'm so old, these young folks, what they think the South will offer them.
Yeah, it's really curious to me, right? Like, I've lived in the New York City area, okay, New Jersey, but, you know, and I live in New York now.
Oh, it's New Jersey. Come on, Jersey girls. We got to stick together.
Jersey girls. You know, for most of my life, except for a few years in college in D.C., which, you know, people say is the South or whatever.
It is the South.
It's totally the South. No one ever wants to admit that.
Where do you think they got the land from? Virginia and Maryland. Okay, go ahead.
Right, but so I don't get it, to be honest. Like, I don't get the South. For me, the South is a very painful place. It's a place where my ancestors left to achieve the American dream. And so it's very curious, but it does seem it's affordable, right? Like, that's the number one reason, I think, that people move down there, that New York City and even places like Chicago,
Boston,
yeah, they're just simply too expensive. But it was like another thing that was like really interesting to me. It was like a humanity. It was a going back to home. It was HBCUs, mm-hmm. A thriving Black middle class that's hard to find, maybe even in places like New York, where kind of the African diaspora is really decentralized. People love that about the South. Someone said, I can be myself. I don't have to look for these spaces. It's home, I guess. And
that's interesting.
And so that was interesting. But then I think the other thing was, it's like, yeah, the South has race issues, but at least they're upfront and open about it. Because the North, they're just as bad, right? Like, they're stop and frisk here in New York, or it was. You know, Eric Garner was happening. There are all these issues right here in New York City and other places in the North. And it was like, well, the North isn't, like, really the promised land for us either. So I might as well go somewhere where it's warm and, you know, like, there's a sense of home and there's sweet tea mm-hmm. and, you know, there are all these HBCUs and a thriving Black culture. But also I should say that I think about Juicy, right? I think about the title of the book. Like, even hip hop feels like that's like not rooted in New York anymore. Like, when I was growing up, it was Biggie. Mm-hmm. It was Jay-Z who lived in, you know, New York City and Little Kim, Marcy Projects. Like, that was that's where their dreams were realized. And then a lot of them moved to New Jersey, actually. But
Alpine.
Yes, Alpine, right? So a lot of them did move there, but it doesn't feel like the dream is rooted there. You look at, like, the Real Housewives of Atlanta, like, right? Mm-hmm. These are shows and things, Donald Glover's show, Atlanta. It feels like the dream is, like, less rooted in New York anymore as well.
My guest is Mernequa Allen. The name of her book is It Was All a Dream, A New Generation Confronts the Broken Promise to Black America. So I'm wondering about this. It's interesting. It was really interesting to read it, and I have nieces who are millennials and trying to do their thing. And I think about, they grew up in an Obama world, right? Yeah. And so some of this is, and you know, it's on Obama's Instagram page today. It's a picture of him and Michelle. He's got his arm around her. Today's her birthday.
Yeah, I saw that.
They're like couple goals, right? So this idea that it's all possible, look at this beautiful couple and all they've accomplished and all the people that they've introduced the United States to, whether it be Eric Holder and all their friends and Valerie Jarrett, and then what happens next.
Oh, yeah.
So that this sense of almost a false sense of what's possible.
Right.
I mean, I don't want to say anything. I mean, I think Obama's an amazing intellect and all that, but what happened after, was it a false sense? Was it too much of a warm blankie for young Black millennials?
Oh, my God. Absolutely. So I was doing the reporting for most of this book, you know, is Obama was exiting his presidency. And I think, you know, and I think whether you like and agree with his politics is one thing, but the symbolism of Barack Obama, what that meant to millennials, most of them, the large bulk of them, were really coming of age with him in the White House. And Obama's like an exceptional person, like, yeah, obviously, and so is Michelle. But oh my gosh, like, what has happened after? And not just after now, whatever's happening in D.C., because that's its own unique thing. But even the language, I mean, Black Lives Matter came about during the Obama presidency. We saw Mike Brown laying out in the streets while Obama was president. Trayvon Martin, I think, mm-hmm, was, like, you know, one of the first big things. That was happening under an Obama presidency. It feels different. And people, young people particularly, have said they noticed a change. It seems like they said, you know, racism, just, it's okay to be a racist now. Charlottesville was not like old people. And I, mm-hmm, think that that's hard for us to internalize, right? We grew up when mostly, I mean, MLK was a day everywhere. We grew up with Oprah, you know, there were all these signs of Black success and Black people making it. And right, it wasn't the day of our parents. And to have this happen, to see how race relations has played out in the last few years as we've become adults in this, like, we are the world type, right? That, mm-hmm, that happened when we were young. I think it is really devastating.
What about family? What about marriage, dating, children?
Oh my gosh, that's everybody's favorite topic of conversation to talk about. Whatever chapter I was reporting on, that would inevitably come up.
We're humans. We want to be with other humans.
And they want to talk to me about it all the time. That's rough. I think it's young, right? So the statistics for Black millennials are they are the marriage rates are far below. And there was a pressure. There was kind of two things going on. I think there was a pressure to be Barack and Michelle for a lot of people, mm-hmm, particularly for Black professionals. They talked about that. They talked about couple goals. But then those on the other end of the spectrum talked about all these things that are going on now, right? Like, you can not be married. I think that's a big part of the millennial generation and the narrative, right, of the millennial generation that the media is making. Millennials aren't getting married, but they're coupled up, right? Young Black people felt like they couldn't make those choices in the same way, right? Their untraditional kind of relationship choices were judged differently. You know, they were the baby mamas, like, right? Mm-hmm. Michelle Obama was a baby mama. It wasn't some, like, revolutionary feminist practice. It was like, you are doing thing wrong. You know, it was a pathology, you know, given to them and put on them. And so it felt like their choices were still being monitored, that they couldn't be, again, it's this idea of freedom that they didn't lack. They couldn't be unconventional, right? Like, I know even someone, when I started dating someone, they're like, oh, girl, you need to get married. Like, you can't just be out here, like, having any, you know, babies. And, you know, so that is, like, a big thing for this generation. And interestingly, also for the men as well, they felt the pressure to be the Barack Obama. One young man said, I feel like I need to date a black woman because of this. And I shouldn't say it's not just the heterosexual folks, right? Like LGBTQ folks, one of my favorite interviews, Richard, talked about how hard it was dating, but he also talked about class and how it felt like he needed to have his stuff together to date. Like he wanted to feel complete and whole, and that was hard because he felt like, you know, there are all these economic things that were holding him back. So I think it's tough. No one has the answer. A trans woman was like, I don't know either. It's tough, you know, skin color, all those things are, you know, still have a role. And then one thing we haven't talked about is social media, and you know, people felt like the need to be perfect and to present in certain ways. So they were just, I mean, relationships are hard in general, right? And then there's like Tinder and all this stuff, and it was hard. I think they're feeling it.
So my last question is, you said people, everybody wanted to talk about that subject. What was the subject that you had to pull teeth to get people to talk about that they really got, they were a little bit uncomfortable or a lot uncomfortable, that was just tough?
You know, I don't think that there was one thing. I think it's a good question. I think the thing that surprised me and the thing that I didn't ask about was mental health. There was a lot of depression, a lot of anxiety that people had, that, but they were pretty forthcoming about that. I would have to nudge a little bit to have them talk more about it. But people were very open about that. And I think that was surprising to me and that's depressing.
That's a cool part of reporting, though, when something emerges organically.
And it was everywhere. Everyone talked about like suicide, and not everyone talked about suicide, but a lot of people talked about suicide and just feeling sad.
It's a great read. The name of the book, It Was All a Dream, A New Generation Confronts the Broken Promise to Black America. Reneke Witt will be speaking at the Half King on Monday on MLK Day at 7 p.m. So join her and enjoy the Half King while it's still there. Reneke, thanks for coming to All of It.
Thanks, Allison.
Coming up, we'll attempt to demystify love with a little help from author Laura Mucha. She interviewed hundreds of strangers from 8 to 95 for her new book, Love Understood, The Science of Who, How, and Why We Love. We'll be right back. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. Finding love is just a swipe away, right? Or left, I get confused. That's what dating apps would have you believe. They even have their own publications these days. Tinder has a new site called Swipe Life with articles like, I flew to another country for a first date. And Bumble has the Beehive. There you can read something titled, How to Make the First Move. But despite the flood of information and advertising, finding love may be as much science as it is luck. Laura Mucha, an award-winning poet and broadcaster, spent years talking to people about love and diving into the science behind it. Her latest book is Love Understood, The Science of Who, How, and Why We Love. Laura, welcome to All of It.
Hi, thank you for having me.
One of my favorite headlines about your book was called, it said, Love Factually. Yeah. Take off on the romantic comedy, Love Actually.
Yeah.
So as we talk about love and we talk about the science of love, what were you looking at? Brain chemistry, physical reactions, what goes into the science of love?
Well, so the way that I kind of approached the book was to just approach random strangers around the world across more than 40 countries on every continent. And then when they would tell me things, the interviews would raise questions, and then I would try and answer those questions with science. And so each interview sort of raised very different questions. So one lady, for example, talked about how her husband had had four affairs for 7 years at the same time. And she was like, well, was that him? Was that his personality? Was it my fault? Was it because the relationship was unhappy? And so then I tried to look into whether any of those things contribute, what makes people more likely to cheat. And then in another one, a lady who in her 20s and 30s, she was from the US actually, had only dated married men, said, don't give me drugs, give me a married man. And I wanted to understand that. And when I looked into it, I was genuinely really surprised to find out that the part of the brain that's engaged when you fall for someone is the same part that's engaged when you take cocaine or amphetamines. And they've done tests on rats. They don't do these tests on humans anymore because they don't think it's ethical. They did a few, and in the few that they did, the humans tested on would fall for the experimenters and likened it to sexual orgasm, you know, being stimulated in the brain's reward system. And the rats that were given electrical stimulation would opt for starvation just to get that high. And so, you know, when she said, "Don't give me drugs, give me a married man," she was genuinely, like, accurately describing what's going on in the brain. So that's kind of how I went about it. And I found it really fascinating.
Love makes you high. I guess it kind of makes some sense. So I think this is, I've realized that a lot of people who have interviewed have asked you this question, but it's the one that just jumps out at you. You start the book with infidelity.
Yeah, I know.
Why do you start the book with infidelity?
Well, so I used to be a lawyer, and the way that my natural kind of lawyer brain wanted to begin the book with definitions and being really clear about what lust was and romantic love was and what I think, you know, is the kind of love that makes relationships last, which is companionate love. But I think that probably I decided that the best way to introduce that idea was to talk about infidelity. So, for example, the lady I mentioned who talked about don't give me drugs, give me a married man, her interview really highlights the fact that what she was experiencing with these guys was very different to the love they may or may not had with their wives, which would have been companionate love, a much calmer type of love, which isn't like taking cocaine. And it's more like, you know, just feeling happy and comfortable if you have a good relationship, of course. So I think it's, you know, I wanted to start by really illuminating that difference rather than going in with the slightly drier definitions, you know?
It's really interesting. You do have these definitions, and it's funny, I see you say, in a legal contract, it says this. You've said, and you say it much better than it, companionate love?
Companionate love.
Companionate love.
Yeah, it's a funky word. Yeah.
What is the science behind companionate love?
Well, so the idea is that it's just engaging a total, a different set of neurochemistry. So it's not, so dopamine is a chemical messenger that's involved with all the stuff that I was talking about with the rats. So the idea is that in the brain's reward system, dopamine gets fired, and dopamine just says, I don't care what it was, do it again. Give me that high again. I don't know who it was. I don't care if they're an appropriate person to have a relationship with. I don't care if they're a psychopath. Get that high again. Whereas in more companionate love, dopamine is long gone, and it's more about vasopressin and serotonin and oxytocin, which is called the cuddle hormone colloquially. So it's just much calmer. Yeah, it's more about social bonding. It's just less intense.
Well, to continue with that discussion of bonding, you have attachment theory. That's another big area of research around relationships. Can you explain what attachment theory is and the different kind of personalities defined by attachment theory?
Yeah, I am so glad you brought that up. It's like my favorite topic. I tell everyone, I go to parties and I'm like, nice to meet you. Have you heard of attachment theory? I just think people don't know about it enough. And it's so important. It's like people will say, oh, you know, I met this person and they were tall and they were funny. And I'm like, no, but what was their attachment style? Attachment theory relies on the basic premise that we're very different in the way that we approach and understand and experience relationships. So there's no kind of one experience fits all. The idea is that when you're growing up, you need one of two things, a safe base from which to explore, a secure base from which to explore, and a safe haven in times of crisis. And if you get that, which 58% of the population do, according to international studies looking at 10,500 people, then you will feel comfortable with intimacy and commitment. You won't feel stressed out by marriage, for example. You'll be realistic. You don't find arguments threatening. And relationships basically come very easily to you. But 42% of the population don't have a secure attachment style. So one type of insecure attachment style is avoidance. And that's what I used to have as a result of losing one of my parent figures. So avoidant attachment is basically an idealization of independence and a slight sense of suffocation in a relationship. And avoidant people highly avoidant people, because there's a spectrum. So you're not kind of avoidant or not, you're somewhere on the scale. So people who are more avoidant have a tendency to puff themselves up because they want to see themselves as independent and to find the negatives in their partners. And this is absolutely what I used to do. So I would just have this sense of like, oh God, I've just got to get out of this relationship. Mm-hmm. Their nose is too big, or, you know, their earlobes are too dangly, or whatever it would be. The other really important thing about avoidant attachment is that people who are more avoidant don't connect with their emotions. So they don't really know what's going on. They can't really listen to their emotions as a guide. So that is about 19% of the population. And then 23% have an anxious attachment style, which is very different from being anxious in the traditional sense of the word. So having an anxious attachment style is the opposite of avoidance. So instead of wanting space, you want to be close to your partner all the time, and you feel a bit stressed out when you're not close to them. So I interviewed someone from the US about this. She was lovely, and she described how it felt like something heavy on her chest, and how she would kind of climb over her mother all the time just to kind of have a sense of safety. And then when she was older, she would go for the wrong guys, but then when she was with them, she'd want to be close to them. And when they wouldn't respond, and this is quite a classic anxious behavior, if say you're going out with someone and they're in a business meeting and you can't get through to them on their phone, someone who has an anxious attachment style is more likely to think they're not answering because they don't love me, or they're with someone else, or they're more sensitive to threats, rather than thinking, oh, they're in a meeting or whatever. Whereas someone avoidant probably wouldn't make the phone call in the first place. when you get to that point, you can, as someone with an anxious attachment style, you might then go into what psychologists call protest behavior, which is what might sound a bit like, well, I don't want to speak to you anyway, or I'm too good for you, or, oh, now you call me, kind of behavior. So a need to be really close, followed by like a mega anger, frustration, grump when you don't get that. And the other important thing to say about people with an anxious attachment style is that they do connect to their emotions, but they don't really regulate them. So they're hypersensitive to threats.
That sounds unpleasant. Yeah, the receiving end of, to be honest.
Yeah, and they don't calm them down. So, and those two often end up in relationships together, which isn't great because they want completely opposite things. One wants space and the other one wants to be close.
I'm talking to Laura Mushin. The name of her book is Love Understood, The Science of Who, How, and Why We Love. Chapter 10 has a great title, Sex, Swans, and Swingers. I'm going to read this. Very few animals are sexually monogamous, and DNA testing has shown that many of those we thought were aren't. Are we among those animals?
Well, there's one question is it relevant what is natural? You know, some argue that violence is natural. Does that make it what everyone should be doing? But I also think probably on balance, maybe we're not meant to be sexually monogamous. So, you know, as I explain in that chapter, the vast majority of animals are not monogamous. And even the animals we thought were, like swans, at 40%, DNA testing suggests that 40% in any given clutch is fathered by a different father. So I find it really interesting, the idea. But even if you move away from animal studies, even amidst humans, there are like infidelity rates, depending on the study, are up to 70% for women and 72% for men. And then you have, you know, 46% of countries around the world accept marriage to more than one person. And then even amidst the countries where, say, monogamy is the norm, in the US, for example, a study showed that 21% of people have tried non-monogamy. So, I mean, where exactly are the people who are actually being monogamous successfully? Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that I don't believe in it or recommend it, because I think there are huge benefits to it. But, you know, to assume that it's the right or universal or natural thing, I think is incorrect.
It's so interesting because this book draws from psychology, philosophy, anthropology, and statistics. It's a big mix. So I want to ask you a couple of some of the most tried and true and a little bit trite questions or ideas about love, because I'm curious to see what the science would be. Love at first sight. Is there any science behind that? Do you know immediately? Can you know immediately? Does your body know me? Does your brain know immediately?
So my view on this is no, I don't think it exists. And I thought about this for a long time, and I went to Cambridge to interview a leading professor of lust. He's a professor of philosophy, sorry, I should say. But he has a book on lust. And I talked about it with him. His name is Simon Blackburn. And I was like, look, I don't buy it. I've interviewed as many people who thought they were in love and got it right as people who got it totally wrong, and people who were convinced it was love, but then actually, you know, they fell for pathological liars. And so I think what he and I talked about was the idea that lust has the potential to turn into love. That initial connection you have with anyone could turn into love, but love, companionate love at least, requires a certain timescale and history. And the science shows us that what's going on at the very beginning is basically a kind of, hey, this person's a good person to reproduce with, go for it. You know, it's not, oh, is this a person you could spend the rest of your life with? So I think actually that's strangely less about science and more about philosophy, as what do you think love is? And if you think love requires time, then love at first sight can't exist because love requires time. Do you see what I mean?
I do. Last question. So many people say, don't go to bed angry. Arguments are bad for a relationship. The science seems to suggest otherwise.
Yeah. So I interviewed a 95-year-old poet who I thought was brilliant on this. And he said, you know what they say? Don't ever go to sleep on an argument. But actually, I found it quite useful. And when he went to sleep on an argument, he would wake up with more of the other person in him. I think that arguments are complicated, and again, your attachment style will come into it. So if you're avoidant, you might find arguments are almost a way for you to create distance in the relationship. So you might want to storm off and, you know, not talk and sleep without resolving the problem, whereas that would be quite stressful for someone who has an anxious attachment style. But overall, I think the ideal is to try and resolve it if you can. But I mean, if a 95-year-old poet says it's okay to, and he was married for 65 years and 49 days until his wife died, and they often went to sleep on arguments, and their relationship, by what he described, was brilliant. So, yeah.
With chapters like I Woke Up in the Gutter, Sex Swans and Swingers, Extravagant Expectations, What I Want More Than Anything, the name of the book is Love Understood, is coming out on January 29th. Laura Mucha, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, a conversation with the neuropsychiatrist whose new book looks at the toll of war and violence on conflict photographers. It's called Shooting War. More after a quick break. This is All of It. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Conflict photographers are visual historians. That's what my next guest wrote. That is at the heart of a book called Shooting War, written by Anthony Feinstein, a University of Toronto's neuropsychiatrist, based on interviews with and about 18 conflict photographers and those that knew them. Feinstein looks at the emotional and physical toll that taking these photographs has had on the photographers themselves. What emerges is a powerful exploration of what drives these men and women who continually put themselves within the range of some deadly and dangerous scenarios. Anthony Feinstein, thanks for being in the studio today.
Oh, my pleasure.
So you are a neuropsychiatrist.
Yes.
With that in mind, no pun intended, how did you come up with the idea for this book?
I had a patient who turned out to be a war journalist, and she had developed a lot of emotional difficulties while covering a famine in East Africa. And she came back to Canada, had a very major breakdown, got sent to my clinic, did well with therapy, recovered. And I remember saying to her, why had you never reached out for help? Because you worked for a large news organization. And she said to me, you don't understand my profession, that if you let your bosses know you've got these difficulties, they will never send you out into the field again. And this is going back to 1999. So I was really intrigued by that response, took a break from my usual research work, asked my research team to go and do a literature search on the topic of journalists and war and emotional health. We couldn't find a single publication on the topic.
Oh, that's shocking. Wow.
And so we wrote a grant. Huh. It got funded by the Freedom Forum in Washington, D.C. And we did the first study looking at war journalism and emotional health.
Now, you yourself were conscripted and deployed to a war zone as a young man, correct?
Of course, yes.
Will you share with us where and how that informed the work you did, you've done on this book?
Well, I grew up in South Africa. I got conscripted into the army, got sent to a distant war in Namibia, southern Angola. Did not want to go. I opposed the war. It was a bit like South Africa's Vietnam, I think. And saw a lot of difficult things. I saw, you know, men with post-traumatic stress disorder. I didn't know at the time that this would inform one of my future career objectives, but it did in retrospect. I can see it now. Mm-hmm. I took some photographs up in the war zone on one of these little old Kodak chrome cameras.
Which you were not supposed to bring with you.
Which you were not supposed to do, but many conscripts did.
Which is very telling.
Yeah. So I have these, you know, fading images of a distant, forgotten war, which are a powerful reminder to me of my own vulnerabilities, because this was a very dangerous time. But I think, looking back, I think it was instrumental in my current interest in war photography.
One of the emerging themes in the book is the idea of moral injury. How do you define moral injury?
So this is a sense of a person losing their moral compass, that somehow they have betrayed their own moral beliefs, that their behavior might have transgressed what they would see as a moral boundary. And it's not a mental illness, but it does come with strong negative emotions such as shame and guilt. And journalists certainly do experience moral injury in relation to their work. And I write about it in the book, and there are a couple of very graphic examples of that in the book.
Would you share an example?
Sure. So there's this wonderful photographer, Corinne Dufker, who started out as a psychiatric social worker and then gravitated into war photography, did marvelous work, almost like humanitarian work with her photographs, very driven to tell the stories in photographs of people who had been dispossessed by war. And she built up a celebrated career. She got lots of awards, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, at the height of her career, she realized that she was doing this work for the wrong reasons. She was chasing awards and looking for kudos and praise. And she very open about one particular incident when the American embassy in Nairobi was bombed by Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And she got to the story quite late, and they couldn't use her photographs. And she was, you know, very angry at herself. And then she started to question, well, why am I angry? You know, what am I doing this work for? And she felt very bad, guilty about her emotions, and overnight decided to give up this work and do something different. So, you know, the powerful negative emotions of moral injury drove her in a different direction, and she started to work for Human Rights Watch, where she remains to this day doing wonderful work. She ended up winning one of these MacArthur Genius Awards for her work in human rights. But, you know, her sense of having let herself down morally, that she transgressed some kind of moral boundary, made her change careers.
There's an interesting story as well. Photographer's last name is Silva,
yes,
who lost his legs in Afghanistan after he stepped on a mine. But that injury, his moral injury almost seemed to haunt him more than his physical. Will you explain to folks what his particular moral injury, the one you describe in the book? It's fascinating.
Well, you know, Jao Silva was a very brave and courageous man, South African, mm-hmm. who stepped on a landmine in Afghanistan, lost his legs. Very difficult recovery from that. But looking back over his career, he cites the incident in South Africa in the run-up to the first elections back in the 1990s, in which he was covering a very dangerous story in one of the black townships of South Africa, and a close friend of his, a fellow photographer by the name of Ken Easterbrook, was killed. And you know, Zhao wanted to help when his friend was injured, but people were tending to him already, so he took a photograph. And the last thing that he did was to take a photograph of his dead friend. And Ken Easterbrook's wife was furious at Zhao Silva for doing this. And that caused Zhao an enormous amount of pain. Very difficult, I think, for him to get over that. And interestingly enough, when he drew a comparison between, you know, the emotional pain of that versus the very great physical pain of losing his legs and his injury in Afghanistan, he said to me, looking back, the earlier episode in South Africa had been in some ways more difficult for him.
My guest is Anthony Feinstein. He has written a book called Shooting War. It's taking a look at the emotional toll of war and difficult situations on conflict photographers. Now, someone listening at home who is not a neuropsychiatrist says, wow, isn't that PTSD? What's the difference?
Yeah, so PTSD is a mental illness. You know, moral injury is not. Mm-hmm. So PTSD has got a very clear set of defining criteria, you know, divided up into four symptom groups, re-experiencing trauma, unwanted recollections of trauma, avoidance of memories of trauma, your body's autonomic nervous system becomes hyper-aroused, you cannot sleep, can't concentrate, you have a very prominent startle response, and you have a negative, pessimistic outlook for things that are going to happen to you. So that in a very quick summary is PTSD. Moral injury is not that. Moral injury is not a mental illness. Moral injury is a sense of you somehow transgressing this moral boundary, as I said. And in response to that, you might develop symptoms of shame or guilt. If you don't deal with moral injury, then it might become a conduit towards things like PTSD and depression.
Is there anything specific to visual journalists? Are they vulnerable in a different way than print journalists?
Yeah, great question. I mean, we've looked at that. I think, you know, the visual, the photographers have to get very close to what they're doing. They can't hang back. So there's this proximity to grave danger. You know, the print journalists can write about things at a bit of a distance. The photographers can't do that. So in theory, the closer you put yourself to something that's very dangerous, potentially the more likely you are to get hurt, perhaps physically or psychologically. So it's a very good question.
Did you find at all that people became numb in any way? These photographers, that they were just taking pictures of an object over there, even if the object was a dead body?
I think sometimes that happens. I think you habituate to all this violence. I think if you habituate for too long, you're not going to be a good journalist. Obviously, you're not going to be a great photographer. But I'm sure from time to time, the body just shuts off. Interestingly enough, the sense of numbness is one of the avoidant type symptoms of PTSD. In other words, You can't feel the kind of emotion anymore. Your body just shuts down. And that's a maladaptive negative response to what you really should be feeling.
But that's different than resilience.
Yes, it is. I think, you know, resilience is a positive thing, right? Mm-hmm. It helps you deal with adversity. You know, to shut down and feel numb about something that you really shouldn't feel numb about is a maladaptive coping strategy. That's not resilience.
There's one profile that is interesting because it's not necessarily what we think of as a conflict zone or a war zone. It's Ashley Gilbertson, the book Bedrooms of the Fallen. What kind of emotional impact did this have on him versus someone who runs to a war scene?
Well, I mean, he had this awful experience in which he was an embedded journalist with American troops in the Iraq War, the Battle for Fallujah, and wanted to go and take a particular photograph of a dead insurgent in a mosque, you know, the story, and he was told to take a military escort with him, and the escort went before him, and the soldier in front of him was killed, and Gilbertson blamed himself for the death of the soldier and experienced an enormous amount of distress, grief, and guilt at what had happened to the soldier. And then he embarked on this remarkable photographic project in which, I think in some ways to deal with his own grief and what he was feeling, he began taking photographs of the bedrooms of fallen soldiers. And so the families, you know, the parents would let him in to the bedrooms of their sons and occasionally daughters. And in these, you know, very quiet, still black and white photographs, you see the bedrooms of these young men who are not coming home. Very, very painful images, but really like a powerful anti-war document, you know. You see the beds made up, in some cases the cuddly toys still on the bed, you know, the books and mementos of these youngsters who are not coming home. Very painful book, but I think it was cathartic for Gilbertson and helped with his healing process.
And my last question for you is, you focus on Tim Hetherington, and you interviewed Sebastian Younger. He was here last week to learn more about Tim. I know people who knew Tim. And he's one of the few people, obviously, you didn't interview because he's passed away.
Yeah.
What did you learn through these interviews from friends and colleagues and loved ones?
Of Tim Hetherington?
I think in general, Tim, and in general, yeah.
Of this group, these photojournalists? Yeah. I mean, I think there are a remarkable bunch of people. I mean, think about it. They voluntarily go to war year after year, decade after decade, their exposure to violence and war, I think, is unparalleled. They see more conflict than soldiers, and they're doing it voluntarily to keep us informed of events that we really should know about. You know, in an interconnected world, we need to know what's going on far from us, because these events have the ability to affect us. And so I think they, you know, perform a very important civil function, but the cost that comes with it can be quite high.
The name of the book is Shooting War. It is by Anthony Feinstein. Thank you so much for joining us in studio. We really appreciate you sharing your work.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and I'll see you on the other side of the news.